This is episode number 58.
Our head of research has often spoken. He speaks about the five D's, and you mentioned it before: diagnosis, drugs, devices, data, and digitization. And those five D's will bring us in the end, so along our value chain, to the best service we need for our patients. And this is what we need to focus on in integrated patient care.
In this episode, I'm having a conversation with Bettina Ressel, Public Affairs Head Europe Consumer Healthcare at Sanofi. Bettina Ressel joined Sanofi Austria in May 2017 as Country Head, Public Affairs and Patient Advocacy. From April 2020 to June 2021, she was also responsible for corporate communications and finally took over the position of Public Affairs Head Europe Consumer Healthcare at Sanofi on July 1, 2021. Ressel has 15 years of professional experience in public and political institutions and was a partner at Thierry Politikberatung between 2011 and 2013. From 2014 onwards, the 41-year-old worked for the US pharmaceutical company AbbVie in the area of government affairs and market access. From 2008 to 2011, she worked as an advisor for university policy in the cabinet of science ministers Johannes Hahn and Beatrix Karl. Before that, she was a consultant at the Federal Ministry for Health and Women under Maria Rauch-Kallert from 2005 to 2007, and a member of parliament for Rauch-Kallert when she rejoined parliament in 2007. She also headed the office of the United Nations Association Austria from 2002 to 2005. The mother of three children studied political science and Russian at the University of Vienna and attended the master's degree in public health at the Medical University of Vienna. She also completed the political management course in Berlin and the sixth strategic leadership course of the Austrian federal government. Her company, Sanofi, is dedicated to supporting people through the health challenges. Sanofi is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on human health, preventing illness with vaccines, provide innovative treatments to fight pain and ease suffering. With more than 100,000 people in 100 countries, Sanofi is transforming scientific innovation into healthcare solutions around the globe. In this episode, we talk about collaboration in the pharmaceutical industry, the pharma value chain, the role of patents, and much, much more around policymaking and how the world will become with a strong pharmaceutical industry. I hope you enjoy the conversation the same way as I did. And let's get started with another episode of the Life Science Gets Together podcast. Today, it's all about big trends in the pharmaceutical industry. And to gain more insights, I'm very happy that Bettina Ressel from Sanofi Austria joins the show. Bettina, welcome to the show.
Welcome, but I'm not from Sanofi Austria. I'm working for Sanofi Europe.
Oh, sorry. What's the difference between Sanofi Austria and Sanofi Europe?
I'm working for one of our global business units, so for the consumer healthcare branch, and there I'm responsible for public affairs for Europe. So I'm the public affairs head Europe for consumer healthcare within Sanofi.
That's amazing. Let me ask you one question. What are the duties of a public affairs head Europe consumer healthcare?
I have on my list to build the strategy for Europe belonging to all public health and public affairs issues. So speaking with our authorities and listening to what happens in the single country, countries of the European Union, also on the level of European Union itself. These are my tasks to do, and I have this special scope of consumer healthcare. So not only as I did it in the past until June, to look into the political system and the public health system for one single country. I do this now for Europe, but not on a local level. So not working for the countries, I work more on a strategical side.
So you are the strategic expert for the pharma industry in Europe, and I think also for global trends. And you have an amazing career. So before Sanofi, I saw in your vita that you worked for AbbVie in the role of government affairs and patient advocacy. What's the difference between public affairs and government affairs? I just ask out of curiosity to get a better overview of the industry.
Yes, our government affairs or government relation colleagues, they, as the name, as the title says, they work only on the area with the governments. So there is also, public institutions and authorities in the scope of the interest of the public affairs people, but the government affairs people, they only work on legal aspects provided by politicians and all what is in the political scope. So from a governmental perspective. And the public affairs people, they also work with NGOs, with patient associations, patient organizations, and all what is in under the umbrella of public health, so to say.
That's very interesting. And the first step prior to that, you worked for the Ministry of Health and Women in Austria as a consultant. What were your duties back then?
I worked for the minister directly, so I was responsible for women's health in her cabinet, as well as for women's affairs. I supported the ministry during the 2006 EU presidency of Austria. So Austria had in 2006, the second time, I think, if I imagine the right way, the second time the presidency of the European Council. There we prepared two minister conferences on health issues. On the one hand, for diabetes 2. And on the other hand, this is the area I was responsible in that times on women's affairs and women's health.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you feeling overwhelmed by the constant stream of dire climate news? Turn that concern into action. Tune in to the Climate Confident podcast every Wednesday morning when I bring you good news and real solutions from the front lines of climate action. Whether you're in business, tech, or just passionate about sustainability, the Climate Confident podcast is your weekly dose of optimism and inspiration. Subscribe to Climate Confident on your favorite podcast platform and start your Wednesday with hope and actionable insights.
That's great. And these are all full-time roles. And besides that, you run a family with three kids and, as I learned before, two cats.
Yes. I ever said I would like to be a mom of five kids, and now I have three children and two cats.
Yeah, I have two cats at home, so it's quite funny to watch them. Let me ask you one question towards the last year, which in my opinion was an amazing experience, especially in working in the pharma industry. In a panel discussion last year, I got the question, it was about April, May 2020. How long do you think will it take that the vaccine and the therapeutic hits the market? So I started thinking and found three reasons and said, okay, First of all, we have tough regulatory processes where, let's say, how should I say it in a very polite and nice way, a lot of proper report writing has to happen, even when the data is available. So this just takes time that scientists sit together and write. But okay, if everything goes fine, then we have the second problem, which usually when we do phase three trials is fundraising. So someone needs to go out on the market and find the funds to conduct the trial. Either it's a pharmaceutical industry, pharmaceutical company player, or it's VCs, or it's governments, or a mixture of all that. And knowing all these processes with VCs and with pharma companies and with governments, they usually take 1 to 2 years time until they are completed. And then the third thing is manufacturing. So taking these all three together, my experience was from the past before 2020, even if the product is already on the market, we need to do a phase three trials, I assume 2 to 3 years. So approximately until everything is done, wrapped up and nice and tidy and ready to go to market, especially the manufacturing part, which I consider to be the toughest part to scale something up in no time. And this was my answer also. I think, okay, we are in 2020, so I believe we will come to the end of 2021, beginning of 2022, when we can expect that manufacturing starts at scale and then slowly it will be rolled out. And then incredible things happened. I saw a level of collaboration in the industry that I never experienced before. And this made me think and said, okay, does this have a chance to remain, or is it just one moment in time? And I'm curious to hear your opinion, your professional opinion. What do you think? Can we conserve parts of this global collaboration and hyperspeed that we saw in the last 12 months and transfer it also in other therapeutic areas?
Sure. Sure. I absolutely agree with you that we will have this collaboration in future again. And what we also know is that nearly 2 years after the start of the corona pandemic, because the pandemic didn't start in Europe, outside Europe, we have in December, I think, 2 years. And we know that the COVID-19 virus will keep us busy for even longer, I think. And it is necessary that the industry, not only the industry, also the politics, the science, that we all work together in times, not only in times of the pandemic, but also what you mentioned, that we take this opportunity, we learned that we can collaborate and bring this also in other areas of public health interest. The exceptional situation may have ushered in a new era of cooperation in the healthcare system. It was a great and a huge momentum. And in any case, I have been impressed, really impressed, by a very positive development in the past few months, because thanks to the good cooperation between science, authorities, industry, and politics, we have managed to develop completely new and effective vaccines against COVID-19. And in an incredible short time to produce, you said it also before, it was just 11 months. We never expected to have a medication in our hands in 11 months. And we have accomplished what medical research and development has usually taken years to achieve. So for this purpose, all those involved have bundled their strength and knowledge. At Sanofi, for example, we decided very early to make our capacities available for filling the BioNTech vaccine in Frankfurt in order to get the urgently needed vaccine onto the street as quickly as possible in the largest possible quantities and in excellent quality, which is also very much important, not to have the medication in hand, but that all quality aspects have taken into account. And Sanofi was the first to take such a cooperation approach, but other companies followed. We see it now that there are a lot of corporations between pharmaceutical companies, which were before opponents. And now we decided to work together against our one single opponent, which is the COVID-19 virus.
Now this teaming up is let's say, helps really to keep this speed up at an extremely high level. You said it, 11 months. I mean, when I think back to the first quarter of 2021, it started even in science. So the speed, how the exact sequence of the virus was identified and transmitted to the pharma industry, to other scientists in the world, was incredible. Then the second push that came was in diagnostics. Mm-hmm. And the third push in vaccines, and now we see the third push in therapeutics. And the question I ask myself is, of these changes that we saw, what do you think will be integrated long-term into the value chain? How will the value chain change? Will this, let's say, this teaming up of the pharma industry really define the next 10 years?
I have here in mind what our head of research has often spoken. He speaks about the five D's, and you mentioned it before: diagnosis, drugs, devices, data, and digitization. And those five D's will bring us in the end, so along our value chain, to the best service we need for our patients. And this is what we need to focus on in integrated patient care. And how do the five D's interact? So first of all, we have diagnosis, as you said. Mm-hmm. Because without an exact diagnosis, it is not possible to select a suitable drug and the correct dosage for the patient. And for example, personalized medicine, which we talked about very much before the pandemic started. We spoke mainly about personalized medicine. Modern diagnostics offer us more and more opportunities. Also the pandemic showed how important diagnostics and diagnostic tests also can be for analyzing. On the one hand, we saw it with the PCR tests, how crucial it could be or how crucial it is to have fast diagnostic tests for analyzing the virus. On the other hand, we need these diagnostic tests also for analyzing the genetic information of a patient, or measure the relevant biomarkers that surface indicators for a disease state or for the effectiveness of a drug. So diagnostics play a much more important role, I think, in the upcoming years. We see it now, actually, and we will take these into the next decade of developing diagnostics.
You mentioned one keyword, which is personalized medicine and the patient focus. And I just thought, and I agree completely to that, I think this is a paradigm shift. So when I started 2006 in the life science industry, it was very much about treating diseases. And mm-hmm. now coming from the other side and coming from the patient and say, okay, I mean, the patient in a certain condition, what care does this patient need? Is this the right picture that I got from what you said?
Yes, it's not only a tailor-made treatment. So when we're talking about personalized medicine, we do not only talk about the treatment itself. The drug is only a part of the personalized overall solution. This is exactly what the informed patient increasingly expects, because our patients, the knowledge about health and their treatments and drugs is increasingly high, or increased very, very high in the last years. You have a lot of sources where you can gain information about medicines, about drugs, about diseases, etc. So at Sanofi, we use the individual needs of the patient, and we are in close collaboration with patient organizations, and we listen to them, what they need, not only from a treatment perspective. We see the patient in our center, and not only from a treatment perspective or not only from a drug provider perspective. We bring those needs of the patient into our research system. So our patients inspire us to break new ground, and we can learn from them a lot. It's also very necessary to have not only clinical trials data in this aspect. We also need real world data, to build real world evidence and bring it together with the knowledge of the clinical trials back into our research system, so that we can provide even more quickly the right medication for our patients.
Let's stay a little bit with this value chain thinking, which I really like. So it's one of my favorite topics. And when people asked me in the last 15 years, how do you make your money? Tried as a very simplified approach. Maybe it's oversimplified. I always said, on one hand, you have amazing scientists who are much smarter than I am and who spend their entire days to discover new solution to potential existing problems. And it's a very creative process. And they, especially here in Europe, with a lot of public support and great universities and research organizations, produce innovation at a very large scale. Then on the other side of the equation, you have the pharma industry, who is responsible, in my opinion, to bring products to patients and to do it also at hyperspeed, at scale, and as we saw in the last 12 months, I would say at light speed, to really rolled it out very quickly to make sure that patients that suffer get the right solution. And in between, we have the early stage development, which is a little bit critical because it's not so much on the pharma side, which is very structured. It's also not so much on the science side, but it needs the qualities of both worlds integrated in very small entities. And these are called startup companies, scale-up companies, early stage companies. And their job is to translate science into prototypes in all the 5 Ds that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. So one is therapeutic, drugs, or the other one is diagnostics. And this is a very specialized field. And my role in this field is to help companies and scientists to find parties who want to develop those innovations and also who want to fund that. And the problem is in that area that 9 out of 10 projects fail because the science is not really translatable into products, not because people fail, but because it's just the nature of science. Not everything can work, which we hope that works. The question that arose in the last year with all these changes in the industry, what effect has this on pharma companies? Are pharma companies now eyeing more towards the early stage development, which before I perceived that the ideal handover point for new products would be sort of, let's say, it's not entirely true in all 5Ds, but just stay with one example, which is about clinical phase 2. So it's the really prototype where you can say or see it works. Is there an aspiration in the pharma industry to go in even earlier? Or did I get the wrong perception in the last years of the role of the pharma industry in this critically early stage field?
Our focus was in the last year's research and development. And I think we go in the direction of search the right partner, and develop then together the right medication, the right therapy for which is needed. So we have to be more flexible, I think, in collaborating with universities and research institutes, bringing our interests together. So searching for the right partner in a more flexible and a pragmatic way, I think, because on the one hand you have the pharmaceutical industry, we try to we have a lot of processes. You know, pharma companies, they are working very slowly sometimes, and so we have to bring more speed into our organization. So lean up our processes and bring in more possibilities for those collaborations and cooperations with the startup companies, with research institutes, research companies, so that we be faster in developing the right medication and to have the possibility to bring right solutions to the patients in a proper time, so that it doesn't need any more 12 years to bring in an innovative drug, or even longer. We have to be quicker and faster. But it's not only a matter of time in collaborating with startups and research institutes. It's a mixture of what we also discussed before. So we need data, we need real world data, we need clinical trials, we need even more health data out of the system, and bring these cornerstones all together, and then we will have the possibility to have our productions also and developing systems being faster, that they are faster in the future.
You mentioned the data, and when I look at other industries, it's I'm pretty much amazed what's going on there. I mean, just think about logistics, the big Amazon story that I experienced since 1995. Where Jeff Bezos started with just one bookstore, put it online, and everybody laughed about him back then and said, okay, who will buy books online when you have the bookstore around the corner? And all this evolved into big data solution, where they gathered massive data to really understand what customers need, what their behavior is. And I always wondered, why the public health sector is not so quick in picking up these solutions. And when I look at the data generation that I see in the healthcare system, to me, maybe I have the wrong perception, but to me, it looks like we are still somewhere in the early days of Amazon. And there are a lot more solutions on the market. What is your perception of big data in pharma industry? How will it change over the coming 10 years?
Yes, there is still a lot of room for improvement in terms of data, as well as digitization, because data is available, or is even faster available if you have a digital data system in place, which helps to bring the data into connection. I think that we are on the right way. Yes, we can talk about that we could have a lot of those solutions brought into the system much earlier. Yes, fair enough. But we are now we have learned a lot. So not only the pharmaceutical industry, also the public health system has learned a lot. And on the European stage, there are ongoing projects, ongoing measures. They have brought in a lot of initiatives and showed that the European countries can also collaborate in under the umbrella of public health, what was not imaginable for all those countries before the pandemic arose. We have on the one hand the HERA initiative, which follows the US BARDA model, and now the European Commission, together with the EMA, works on the Darwin project. They would like to build a platform platform, which offers the possibility to bring in all necessary, needed data, healthcare data into one platform. And EMA, I had a conversation with the head of the head of the board of directors. I do not know if I said it now in a correct way, but she told me that they have also an interest in the blockchain technology. So, mm-hmm. like in the consumer good industry, to have the knowledge from where come the medication. So, which components are included in the medication, and that brings us into that gives us together. So, the authorities on the one hand, and the pharmaceutical industry as provider of the products, the medical products, medicinal products, the possibility to join our forces and to know where the medication come from is a knowledge we do not have at the moment for all components. So when you have in your hand a pill, it is not very fast possible to say where does everything included in this small pill come from. So together with the authorities, it would be a great effort to bring in all those information and have this in hand. And also EMA did in the last years a lot of things in a good way, they are a little bit of a front runner compared to the rest of the public health system. So we can learn a lot from EMA as well.
It's good that you point that out, that a lot is going on in the background. I think it's not publicly discussed in the yellow press that there are great initiatives ongoing. I also had a conversation with ET Health recently, and they also pointed out that they are constantly helping and screening startup companies and bringing startup companies together with the pharma industry to figure out how the innovation can improve processes. But as you said, pharma drug development and drug distribution is a complex field, and we have to make sure that everything is safe, and it's not so easy to change, like, let's say, the value chain of distributing books. And mm-hmm. I also believe that the blockchain technology is wonderful for logistical problems, especially when it comes to data transmission. Mm-hmm. I really love this digital world, and I'm a frequent follower on YouTube of videos of famous investors like Kathy Wood, for example, from the ARK Fund. And when we are discussing, I just remember her words in one interview. She said she believes that we will see another golden age of biotech like we had in the 90s. And also Chamath Palihapitiya, I hope I spell his name right, also used the exact same wording. He said, okay, we are at the beginning of a golden age of biotech. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion on that? Would you share this opinion that now, with the effects of the last 4 or 5 years, even before the pandemic, with all this novel technology that we are having, that the entire industry will get a huge push and will continue, let's say, solve the world's biggest problems, health problems, at, how would you say, at hyperspeed?
Yes. I fully agree to those imaginations. I think we are in the beginning of the process, but I'm a little bit concerned about the position of Europe. So I think we have to be very careful not to get left behind here in Europe, because when we are looking into the leading institutes. There are 30 leading institutes, for example, for oncological research. And there are just two institutes from Europe. So there is, on the one hand, the Swedish Karolinska Institute, and on the other, there's the German Cancer Research Center in Heidelberg. When we are looking into gene therapies, there are 90% of all gene therapy studies worldwide that are carried out in the US and China. So we have to catch up here, because after all, we are talking about one of the most important future areas of the pharmaceutical and healthcare industry. So we have to think about how can we strengthen Europe in being not only a follower, but a fast mover or a front runner in all those questions, because 70% of APIs and for innovative medications, they come from Europe as well as from US. We have to build more possibilities and bring in more possibilities into the system for investing in biotech. There is, for example, in the US, we have the Nasdaq, but in Europe, we do not have such investment tools bringing in a budget into the system. And this is crucial for the biotech sector. We need money in Europe. We need investments in Europe. We need private public partnerships in Europe to make it possible that we will be a front runner again, also on the biotech sector, because at the moment biotech technology, I think, is mainly in US. And on the other hand, also because of data protection, for example, in China, and the data protection in China makes me very concerned. So I would like to have the research and all capacities for biotech and biotechnological research back in Europe. Also because we have a very good data protection law, and we need more digitization and more digital data in the public health sector. So this is very, very complex, structure, but we have to think about how we can bring back Europe into the focus of the world's best biotech research sector.
That's an amazing point. I would like to dig a little bit deeper into those points because these are my favorite discussion points in any discussion about life science and biotech. Capital. This is something that I also perceived 5, 6, 7 years ago, which led to the founding of Life Science Get Together initially, which is simply bringing investors and entrepreneurs together to discuss the problem of lack of capital in Europe. And I very often heard, this is not true, we have enough capital. And my perception was, yes, we have enough capital in Europe, but unfortunately, it's not flowing towards the early stage development scene. And my experience was in that area that Europe is a great place to start a company and to start translating science into products. And you shared it a little bit, my view of the world with your words about science, that also in science, it seems like China and the US are front running the process in research with research institutions. You mentioned oncology. We have only two institutions remaining that are best in class in the world, and all the others are in China or in the United States, which I thought it's the other way around. But on the capital side, my opinion always was, okay, man, if we want to start something, we have a great place here in Europe. We get enough support. But the minute we start scaling a new technology towards prototypes and scaling up the manufacturing, maybe it was, I always thought it was just me. Maybe I'm not very proficient in fundraising, but all the rounds that closed, so I'm talking about significant rounds of above 100 million euros, are done in the United States. And all companies that I'm aware of went public in the United States because the funding scene and the investment scene is much more mature in that area. And in Europe, we have great funds, but they usually are smaller in size. And we have not that many funds still, in my opinion, that can support large-scale IPOs, for example, like BioNTech did. I mean, BioNTech also did an IPO on the Nasdaq, or like Moderna, or like Blueprint Medicine, or other companies. What is your opinion on that? Is there do you perceive a change here in Europe that it's already ongoing, that more capital is flowing towards that direction, that we also can create, a public sector, that more companies go public with significant funds raised? Or do you think also in the next 10 years, the usual story will be start in Europe, then go to the US, or maybe China in future?
No, I'm not that pessimistic. I'm really optimist. I'm an optimist in that case, because I had in the last 15-20 months a lot of discussions with people working in the public health sector who are responsible for fundings for future capital as well. So not only in the public health sector as well, on the private and finance sector, and all of them, they agree that we need more of all those tasks you mentioned before, and so that's the reason I think there are things ongoing in the back. On the one hand, the public institutions are talking a lot about the possibilities they have to build up in the next upcoming months and years, and on the other hand, the finance institutions, they also work on products, BioNTech products. So at the moment, we talk a lot about sustainability and environmental and green products also in the finance sector. And I think that they are working also on products for supporting financing and bringing in more capital into the BioNTech and biotechnology sector. So I think there are a lot of initiatives ongoing in the back. They're not discussed publicly, but if you speak to the experts, they tell you a wonderful story, I think.
And I hope it becomes reality. No, it's a great thing. I mean, when I'm doing my research currently, I'm looking for pharma companies to discuss with what is their strategic position, but also big funds like Cathie Wood's ARC Fund. I mean, it's key to success for companies, because somewhere the money must come, and private investors at some point need an exit and to have enough funds to invest in the next generation of biotech companies. And looking at the big funds, I see a lot going on in the United States, and I see very few activities in Europe. And when you say there's a lot going on in the background, I mean, it's really, really promising. I think Europe can start again front running this area. We had a big pharma industry in the past. I mean, I think still the big players are coming from Europe.
Yes, Sanofi also has his own venture section, and we are also working in this field, and so do other pharmaceutical companies as well. But it's not only about pharmaceutical companies. There are a lot of other players on the ground which are interested in the same sphere.
Yeah, and I think the risk can be mitigated very easily when the fund is big enough. So one argument always was, okay, it's too risky. But in reality, it's a game of statistics. When I know 9 of 10 products fail, I just need to invest in 1,000 products, and they have the 10 successes that finance the other ones. So it's a really great area to go into.
Yes, and on the other hand, the pharmaceutical industry works very hard on it, that not 9 from 10 products fail. So we have also have leaner production sites. We have to get faster in producing innovative drugs. And what I mentioned before, digitization is key for getting faster. So This is also one crucial point on our journey. So, on the one hand, we need more capital. We need more venture capital as well, we need to get faster in developing innovative medicines, because innovative medicines, they are the future. They're now here, and also the future area of our industry.
Now I agree. I think with digital products, probably simulation can go much quicker to narrow down the options when it comes to out-licensing from research institution products into companies, that the success rate goes up. I believe that's possible. Let's stay a little bit with the buzzwords. You mentioned already a few that are currently on the market besides SARS-CoV-2. Let's start with SARS-CoV-2, the mRNA vaccine, as we were talking about that already. It's not only against viral diseases like SARS, it's also in oncology. What's your opinion on this technology? Is that it with vaccines against SARS-CoV-2, or do you see more solutions coming to the market in that area that also treat other viral diseases and also serve a purpose in oncology like it was initially meant to be?
Yes, on the one hand, we need to have more research on infectious diseases. We see that there is a huge lack of research work in this area, because 60% of all infectious diseases in humans come from animals, and we have to have more. More knowledge. We need more knowledge about those zoonoses, and I think the mRNA technology could probably bring also here solutions to oppose against the infectious diseases, so to say, if we can opposing to them. And on the other hand, the mRNA technology comes from the oncological research, and in the oncological research sector, there's a lot of research work ongoing, we have more knowledge now about the mRNA technology, and bring it together with this what we knew so far in from the oncological research work we did, and what we have now also connected to real world data, to gaining real world evidence. I think that we will have a lot of more solutions based on the mRNA technology in future, what we know so far. So I do not have a glass ball, and I, as you know, I'm no researcher. So getting here a right answer, you have to speak with a researcher, I think, not with a scientist. So from that, what I know and what we know so far, the mRNA technology can be the basis for next innovations coming in the next upcoming years.
Coming from the investment side, I mean, not from the science side. I also have this feeling. I think the front-running companies like Moderna and BioNTech, in my eyes, don't seem to me like they want to cash out. So all that I hear from their press releases is that they go very much into reinvesting into other disease areas and try out if mRNA vaccines also show benefits for patients in that area. And this is very promising. Another buzzword that I heard recently is longevity research, that I would like to ask your perception on that. In my opinion, when I look at LinkedIn, I get a lot of information from Christian Angermeyer. It's a German investor who lives in the United Kingdom, who is heavily investing into longevity research. And some podcast interviews that I heard from the experts in that area, they say, okay, I mean, one point in time, we will defeat death and people can live basically forever, a minimum of 200 years in great health. It's a nice vision and I would love that. Do you think this is realistic? What's your opinion on that area?
I do not really know if the majority of people is interested in living forever. So it's a more philosophical discussion that we also and the ethical discussion we have to do. There were, I think, 10 years ago, the breakthrough research was done for being, I don't know, 150 years or some like that. I do not really know if, in the end, this is the aim of our humans, of the human beings around the globe to be 150 in the end. I think our aim has to be bringing solutions to people that make it possible that they are not ill, so that they do not suffer from diabetes, from cardiac diseases. This must be our aim, so that people will not get ill that early. So yes, we know that we will get older and have the possibility to live about 100, nearly 100 years. Today, I think in the Western region, we have a range of 80, 85 years in average, how long we live. And so I think we shall be more focusing on bringing solutions to the people that makes them healthy and that they have the possibility to stay healthy. And so that means that we are not only speaking about the pharmaceutical industry and that the pharmaceutical industry brings innovation in medicinal care and therapies to the people. We have to speak about what the world Health Organization said we only have one health, and this one health depends that we work in all sectors together. So the human medicines, the veterinarian medicines, we need the environmental protection. We need also good labor laws that makes it possible that people can stay healthy when even if they are working very hard. So from a physical perspective, so this all comes into one basket, and this one basket is our health. And so also the health system shall work in future. So health in all policies was the one claim before the pandemic. Now we are speaking from one health, and this is crucial. It's not my aim to be 150. I do not know what I need then from several industries. My aim is staying healthy, and I think this must be our aim from all angles of the society and the industry and the system partners.
I couldn't agree more to your statement. And I think this is something positive out of the pandemic. When I look today on social media, I have never experienced so many people debating and discussing health-related topics in all different kinds of ways. But in the end, the awareness is going up. And you mentioned staying healthy, and I think a lot of health, a lot can be done by single people, by people themselves to stay healthy. It's just habits, but many people simply lack knowledge and know-how and the information, how to stay healthy and what are the do's and don'ts. And I think also in the last year, this debate, this social debate started, and it will continue and hopefully bring more valuable information to more people to help them make better decisions every day. And connected with that, I mean, we are having a Zoom call. There's another thing that I'm really curious to hear your opinion about. We are having a Zoom call and we can easily connect and talk and discuss. And when I feel sick, still, I think today I have to go to the doctor, for example, or I have to go to the hospital. And via EET Health and our Incubation Acceleration Program, for example, we have Health Hub Vienna here in Austria. A lot of solutions are already in development. And what's your opinion about patient pharma or patient doctor interaction? Will there be more solutions in future that are also digitally enhanced at scale, so that people can connect anytime, everywhere to their preferred doctor?
Yes, I think that we are in the middle of this process. When we are looking directly here in the Austrian healthcare system, even more services are available now for doctor interactions. There is a telemedicine tool in place. They started bringing in health platforms where patients can dial in, speak with the doctor via Zoom, for example. So this is not future. This is ongoing and is also reimbursed by the social security and the insurance system. So the publicly funded or from self insurance system, the healthcare system. No, the how is it called? The social insurance system. So this is the right name. But we need more services. When we are looking to Germany, they provide the e-recipe from early 22 onwards, so that you call your doctor, even if you're a chronic disease patient. You call your doctor and say, hello, my medication, I need it for the next, 2 months, 3 months. Please send me my prescription. And the doctor can send then the prescription to your mobile phone. So you have there a platform, an application, the doctor bring the prescription to this application, and you go with this application or QR code to your pharmacy and get your drugs, your medication, your therapy, what you need, this is possible from 22 in Germany, and I think we need more of those services that makes it possible that I order from my living room, that I sit on my sofa and I do also my Einkauf.
Shopping.
Yes. Sorry.
It's the favorite activity of mine.
It's still Friday evening. So doing your shopping list for you have if you're getting older, you have a shopping list for medication
I
as well.
I completely agree with that. I have my shopping list also to not forget. I mean, 47 and
not only to have a shopping list, but to do your to order your medication from your living room and to get your medication not from the pharmacy, so that you not to have to go to the pharmacy, but the pharmacy brings it with a delivery service to you. So this must be the future, so that the patient or even the consumer, when we are talking about the consumer healthcare, can have the possibility that the medication is brought by postal and carrier delivery services to your home. so that you not to have to go to the pharmacy anymore or to the doctor to get your prescription, because we need a better access for the people to the healthcare system, to give people the possibility that they have the best healthcare service in place.
I completely agree with that. I mean, on the logistics side, especially for chronically ill people who have difficulty walking, moving or leaving the house, could be a blessing to get more at home. Also, when I think back about the big solutions, I mean, in Vienna, we have this Alles Google test, mm-hmm. which in its essence is the first solution that I saw that diagnostic kits are delivered to the principal healthy people, but let's call it patients. Mm-hmm. When I think about other disease areas, I don't see that. So valid tests, let's say medical valid tests. It's not so these, let's say simplified tests. I think really the hardcore diagnostics. And in its essence, every time when I go to the doctor, it's just taking a blood sample, for example, and or spit on something. And mm-hmm. I think this can be easily done at home by many people and can just... especially for men who don't like to waste the time going for a couple of hours to the doctor for just doing a 5-minute test. I think this can be easily improve, especially in the male population, the acceptance of, let's say, doing the yearly checkup. Do you think there is more possible on the diagnostic side as well, so that the patient can do more for him or herself at home?
It is possible to doing all those tests you mentioned at home. There are a lot of startups and companies which are scale ups now, which provide those services. But you have to pay out of your pocket. Mm-hmm. So the difference is you have to go to the doctor, to his office, and see him for your yearly or bi-yearly checkup if you can't afford all those services. So we have here segmented our society into two parts. The one part who can afford all those services, they have it. They can mm-hmm. they can order it at several web shops, and the other part of the society do not have this possibility because okay. they do not have the money to pay, for example, for a blood test €150. It's a huge amount of money for a lot of people in our country and a lot of people in Europe as well. So we have to think about how can we bring all those solutions into the system. On the one hand, to the reimbursement system, on the other hand, to have solutions, services, medication, which consumers can buy for their own because it's affordable for them. And this is also why we are working very closely together also with the Global Self-Care Federation and other associations as well, to show where the possibilities of self-care also are, so that patients care for their self, but it has to be in the end affordable for the patients and for the consumers, for the people. You're not a patient in the first single contact when you're doing a test on your blood, for example, or blood pressure test.
I mean, this is a great point that you mentioned, driving the prices down. I think Christoph Lengauer mentioned that he's working with a few of his startups, his companies in that area. When I think of drug development, the last figures, the last numbers I heard is that in 2021, bringing one new therapy to the market is about $3 billion or euros. And this translates in very high prices. I think diagnostics is not that expensive, but as you mentioned, still... when a kit costs €150, I think the average income in Austria is about 1,600, 500, 700 euros. So this is 10% of a monthly income. And when you need two, three or four kits, it's not affordable. So I think this is also one of the big challenges that we have to make modern medicine affordable for everybody. I think this is one of the big trends that I hope will remain in our society. One other thing that caught my eye recently was that I read on Facebook, which is a great source of information, that 20% of the population here in Europe suffers from mental illnesses. And Christian Angermeyer, I mentioned his name before, invests in mental diseases, and he wrote one post on LinkedIn that I not 100% agree. He said, in fact, 100% of the society suffer from mental illnesses. They just don't know it. They are not aware of that.
Okay.
And he invests in very interesting approaches. So it's psychedelic drugs, and he's testing in clinical trials if they can make a difference in mental diseases. Then I also read about cannabis products that are tested in clinical trials right now to see the impact. Is this trend only currently with investors, or is it also something that the pharma industry is thinking about picking up?
Mental health and well-being is a very huge part of our work, especially in the self-care sector, because it begins not with the psychological drugs. It begins with your daily routine, the pandemic showed that we need as individuals a lot of things from the society. When you cut all those these possibilities to go outside, to see other people, to meet them, to speak with a lot of other people, to have the possibility to doing sports, being in the nature, you or humans begin to be feeling not that good, so to say. So it begins on the one hand in your social life, but also on the work level. We saw in our affiliate here in Austria that it was crucial to bring in services to our employees and gave them possibilities and give them possibilities for special mental health services. We provided mental health services. We work together with companies who provide those solutions in a different way. There are a lot of sources doing mental health exercises, for example, that brings better health to the people. Those trends on the investment side, I'm not familiar with, but I see that we as an employer, as a Sanofi, as a huge employer, takes this responsibility in mental health and well-being on the one hand as employer, and on the other hand within our portfolio. We also trust that we need more mental health and well-being solutions and services for our customers and clients as well.
Oh, that's great news that the corporates like Sanofi are starting to take care of their employees in a very noble way and very unique way to provide solutions. I think this is amazing, actually. I like it. I'm shamelessly picking your brain. There's another question that I'm very interested in. About it's a debate. I think I became aware of that in summer, where it was publicly discussed if patents should be, let's say, how should we call it, waived or opened, or let's put them aside to make vaccines more available and accessible in the world. And I thought it through for myself and thought, okay. And I thought, is that really a problem, the patents? And I came to the conclusion for myself, I mean, when it comes to vaccines, I don't see the patents as a blocking stone, as the pharma industry is proficient in and out licensing. So this is our daily business, basically, to collaborate with organizations to make sure that technology is disseminated and that it's manufactured globally all over the world with all the physical restrictions. We cannot redefine physics immediately. And I saw the blocking stones more in the area of physics, that the products like an mRNA vaccine are complex products. So it needs a lot of training and a lot of manufacturing sites that cannot be easily set up, like, let's say, producing screws or screwdrivers. It takes time, sometimes years, to set up a new site and produce things at scale. But this discussion about patents and thinking patent processes new, I think, is ongoing. Where do you see the future of patents going as an outcome of this discussion that started in the recent months?
The patent topic is not the right or it is not discussed in the right way, because in the special case you mentioned about the COVID-19 vaccines, they are already available in enormous quantities. Mm-hmm. It's all about the fair global distribution. And this is not only a question of the pharmaceutical industry. To have a fair global distribution is mainly a question for the political side, so for politicians. We do not need the revocation of patent protection, but comprehensive political will. This is what is crucial. And to say the patents are the evil, that is not true. Especially not for COVID-19 vaccines. They were, as we talked before, they were developed in a very short time, and we produced them as well in enormous quantities in a very short period of time. We have we estimated for 24 billion doses. For the whole world.
24 billion.
24 billion doses by 22. So next year, we have an estimated dosage of 24 billion, amount of 24 billion doses available around the globe. And we have 275 manufacturing and production agreements. So the patents are not the problem. It's all about the global distribution and how politicians and the political system would like to bring in the medication into several parts of the world. So they have to negotiate and they have to agree how they will bring in the vaccines where it is needed. So and I think this is the same for other products as well. The patents are not the problem. You need the knowledge to, as you said before, you can't do an mRNA a vaccine or produce it in your garden. And I read in a newspaper 2 or 3 days ago that a representative of an NGO said that this is not rocket science what we are talking about. So I was a little bit confused, because mRNA technology
sounds like rocket science to me. So
yes, to me as well.
It did not go to the moon like Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX, but it's as complex as that topic as a trip to Mars.
So the patent discussion is a discussion which is not discussed, or which discusses not the patent story. It's not about the patents. It's another place where a discussion is ongoing, which brings politicians into the position to say, okay, we are not responsible. Mm-hmm. So I think it would be better to sit down take a breath and bring all the issues to the table and discuss it in a way that brings in the end a solution. At the moment, we only have this discussion on patents by blaming each other. So the political system points to us and says, you are the problem. And we said, as pharmaceutical industry, no, the patents are not the problem. You have to bring in the solution. And this is a discussion which will not succeed in the end.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, every time when I wanted to license something to a pharma company, I mean, if the product works, it was never a problem to enter into licensing discussions and negotiate a deal. I think also the pharma industry understands very well that the production cost of the research have to be refunded so that the researchers can start doing their work on the next generation of solutions. To me, it also looks like it's like health. So when people start taking care of their health, when they get sick, it's too late. And manufacturing, for example, it's the same process. When we start worrying about manufacturing sites, when we have a pandemic, it's just too late. So we need to build resources beforehand. And these events like a pandemic, I mean, new viruses, new bacteria, they will always visit the human race also in the coming decades. And I think we have to take the learnings out of this pandemic to identify the real problems and find real solutions for them. And I don't think that the negotiation process in the pharma industry are really a problem. So it's, I don't see that. But the question is, what are the real bottlenecks? So in your opinion, in the pharma industry, when you look at the industry today, what are the three biggest problems that you think should be solved very quickly in the industry?
First of all, it's all about timing. So it takes too much time for research, development, production. It's needed that we be faster. We be more, much more faster in the future. And this is not only a question which the pharmaceutical industry can answer for its own. So we have to have more collaborations as we did during the pandemic. So collaboration not only between different pharmaceutical companies, we need the collaboration from the beginning. So with startups, research institutes, universities, which we know so far, but we have to bring into connection or to bring possibilities for collaboration more faster into our system so that it's possible on an earlier stage to work together. And on the other hand, there has to be more interaction and more collaboration between the industry and the political system. So health authorities and public health institutions, we have to work more closely in the future. It is what I said before about the patents. It doesn't bring a success in the end when we are not stopping blaming each other. And so it's crucial bringing us forward as an industry, as well as the public health system, that we go together.
Now, I agree with that. I mean, we need to sit down more often across borders, I would say. So pharma industry, scientists, politicians, investors, to identify the real problems and openly discuss what are proper solutions without pointing the finger and say, okay, it's your fault or it's your fault. That doesn't lead anywhere. I completely agree to that.
Yeah, it's all about trust. So we have to build this trust. And if we have trusted partnerships, then we will succeed in the end.
I absolutely agree. Let me ask you one final question. Let's just imagine Elon Musk has one of his glorious ideas and invents a time machine. And we can travel to the year 2031. and look back to 2021. What event or innovation that happened this year, in your opinion, will have the biggest positive impact on the pharma industry in the coming decade? What is the single most important event or innovation that happened this year that will redefine the pharma industry with a very high impact?
This is a very huge question in the end. So, what is the most important event in 21?
That will have the highest impact, the biggest impact on the industry in the coming 10 years.
I think it was in the beginning of 21, when the collaboration between the different pharmaceutical industry companies starts. I think this is one of the most important events whatever happened in our history. It's an historical moment because before the pandemic arose, we were opponents. We were not working together. Only if we buy each other. And so this is one of the most important events, I think. This never happened before, and I think this is a great beginning of collaboration also in the future.
Sound words at the end of this wonderful Friday evening. Collaborate more and trust each other would be my summary of the last 1.5 hours. And this is wonderful advice. And I hope it really happens in the coming 10 years that we keep this spirit of collaboration and start trusting each other again.
Yes, challenge accepted. So I'm a part of it.
Me too. Bettina, thank you very much for your time and these wonderful insights in the industry. Let's collaborate more in the future and chat more often with each other. Have a great evening.
Yes, thank you very much for your invitation.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please share the podcast and make sure you've subscribed. Have a great day.